Route 616, your home for all fans of Marvel main continuity. Hello, everybody. We are back with episode 78 of Route 616, and all three of us are here. Dan has a half-disgusted look on his face, like he's been told he has to cover X-Men comics today.
I assume that was a holdover from him not listening and watching Madam Web.
Oh, I listened to you. And I do trust your judgment, Bill. Don't get me wrong. I trust your judgment.
Yeah, now.
No, way more than Ryan's. Way more than Ryan's.
Well, that's fair. Ryan would have loved it if it was directed by Rob Zombie.
I trusted Dung Beetle's judgment. And Dung Beetles live in poop. Okay. They spend their days making little balls of poop out of big piles of poop. And I still trust their judgment more than Ryan's. But I needed to see it for myself. You know, just head to
please
know.
At least tell me you didn't pay to see it.
Oh, God, no. Do I look crazy? Why would you pay to go see a Marvel movie in the last 4 years? Has there been one Marvel movie worth the admission in the last 4 years?
I'm going to stay quiet because I watched Madam Web the way the gods attended it, completely alone in the theater.
Wow. Oh, that's cold.
What a...
it's well said.
And if Sony Pictures is watching this, that is the complete truth, and there was no torrents of any sort involved in this.
What's a torrent? I know not what means this word.
No, actually, I did go to Madam Web in the theater.
Why?
Because I wanted popcorn.
Man, you must have wanted popcorn some fucking bad. Like, seriously.
I just went into the theater to get a bag of popcorn, and I saw Madam Web was playing, and I'm like, you know what? I've been curious about this. I'll fucking watch it.
That's crazy.
Oh, dear.
So for anybody keeping track, I'm now the only one that hasn't seen Madam Web, so.
You're also, you know. The only one who obviously still has a bit of a life, because Bill's just proven he doesn't. And I'm too old to have a life, so, you know. Yeah. You know. What can I say?
No, I just have other shit to watch before I lower myself to that level.
Oh, sorry. Did you just say lower yourself? We know what you watch.
We've both watched Madam Web. We're not in a position to judge at the moment.
Oh, we are. We are, Bill. Come on. Show some moxie.
Show some moxley.
You're judging Ryan all over the place here, man. Just judgy, judgy, judgy. Judge.
Yeah, but I'm going for the quiet judging where I can't get called out on it at the moment. I call it the pre-Liverpool strategy.
Oh, which is?
Stay very quiet in case we don't win.
Yeah, well.
Because yeah. I wasn't joking when I said in the chat for people who might actually listen to this that I think that match could go either way. I'm not nearly as confident as certain elements of the Manchester United fan base about it.
I cannot believe they're already trash talking us. And this is on like YouTube.
Well, they're probably doing it to get annoyed Liverpool fans to click on their videos.
Oh, probably. Not that we'd ever do that.
No. An annoyed Liverpool fan totally didn't watch those videos this morning and then complained to me about it in the group chat.
I just was shocked that they'd shit-talk us again. You'd think the last couple of times we met up with them, they'd have learned their lesson.
Yeah, but reasoned thoughts don't sell.
Yeah.
Like,
but the truth is, though, this is, if you guys are going to beat us, this is your chance.
Oh, yeah, this is our best chance this year to beat you.
Yep.
But I don't feel confident enough to start running my mouth about how bad it's going to be for you guys. I put it at like a 55% chance that we actually win it. Because we can't draw. It's a cup match, so we can't draw.
Yeah, that's right.
So it really boils to how serious does Klopp take this. If Klopp doesn't care and rests Salah and a lot of the big names and plays the kids just to, you know, fill the field.
Yeah.
We have a chance.
Yeah, well.
With the way we're playing, I don't think it's a good chance against any team.
But that's what Chelsea said when we threw a bunch of academy kids on against them for the EFL Cup.
Like I said, I don't think it's a good chance. We have a chance, but it's still like, even playing kids, you've got a good chance of beating us.
Mm-hmm. Well, Salib's back. He played a couple of days ago.
I was actually shocked Klopp put him in that
just
match.
Just help him loosen up a bit.
Yeah, that's probably what it was just to run him loose, because that was not a match he needed to be playing. You were up 5-1 coming into it.
Yeah, but like right now Klopp's resting Van Dijk, Gravenberch, people like that. He had kids on last night. I'd never even heard their names before.
Oh, yeah, I watched the highlights of that match this morning.
Yeah, there was one kid. I'd never heard of this guy before. He was like, who? Yeah. But apparently it was his very first senior match, so.
Yeah.
But, yeah, Klopp's just praying that Salah and Van Dijk stay healthy.
Yeah, so if he's smart, he won't be playing them this weekend. Because for you guys, it does not matter.
Well, our second string is like Gravenberch, Gakpo, you know, people like that. You know,
yeah.
So we're not in terrible shape.
But I mean, even if you were in terrible shape, for you, the cup does not matter.
No, not this one.
It's not worth breaking Salah over.
Oh, no, it's really not. No. We want him healthy for the end of the Premier League season.
So. Exactly. You've got some tough games coming up again in the actual Premier League. So
yeah,
if I was
guys
Klopp,
again
I'd rest
week.
Him and I'd rest Nunes for sure.
Yeah. But I mean, we play you again, if not next week, a couple of weeks from now or something.
Weeks from now. It's about to start of April.
Yeah. So, yeah. So now that we've trashed Madam Web, the Morbius of Ryan's generation.
Morbius was 2 years ago.
Well, I figure Ryan's just now growing up. You know.
No, I hit my head hard enough today that I might revert back a little bit.
Yeah, a little regression going on there. Oh, but yeah.
So has anyone consumed any good media this week?
The Black Demon. Terrible movie. So much fun. I loved it. Have you heard of it, Ryan?
No.
It's a giant shark movie. Fairly high budget, too, actually.
That kind of takes away part of the point.
It does, but it's very silly. Yeah, I enjoyed it. I got a hell of a kick out of it.
I feel like I watched something the other day, and I don't remember what it was.
Okay.
Yeah.
You said you wanted to talk about Dwayne's new movie.
Oh, no, it was Cena's new movie. That's right. Ricky Stenicki came out. That was... It's a very stupid concept.
Yes.
That if you think about too
it
long, you're
no
like,
sense.
What the fuck? But it's
kinda,
a very fun movie.
Yeah, it's kind of like the movie Tag. It's a really stupid concept, but... Yeah.
John Cena really gets to show his range...
Wow, I can't believe that was a sentence.
So he's beefy and jokey?
Yes.
Yeah.
He's probably the best part of the movie, if we're being honest.
I mean, I'm not going to lie. John Cena's a pretty good actor for wrestler turned actor.
Yeah. Well,
The bar is low on that one. I mean, the only real competition he's got is Dave Bautista.
I think he's at his best
and
when
Rowdy
he's doing
Roddy.
Comedy work.
No, I mean actually good ones. Rowdy had one good movie.
Two good movies.
Okay, yeah,
Frogtown and They Live.
Oh, you're right, three.
There you go. Have you seen They Live yet, Ryan?
No.
Oh, you need to see it. If you've seen Predator and Alien and Mouth of Madness and Blue Event Horizon, you need to see They Live Too.
It's I've seen of two of those.
So. 80s sci-fi. You have not seen Event Horizon?
No, or the one before that.
Oh, In the Mouth of Madness.
Yes.
Oh. Have you seen Serpent in the Rainbow?
No.
Oh. Of course not. Rob Zombie was still making music when those came out.
Yeah, with the contents of his diaper. Just like when he was making friggin' Halloween. Yes. Anything to say, Ryan?
Not really.
So now okay. I'm catching strays too.
I was just trying to put. I was just trying to put over John Cena. Not that he needs it, but
no. Like, so you,
no,
you
the got... man's confident enough to be naked at the Oscars. I don't think he needs more boosting.
No, no, he's doing just fine.
But no, and... Ricky Stenicki was Turn Your Brain Off and Have a Lot of Fun movie. It was quite a bit of fun. The concept is stupid as fuck, but it kind of works if you just.
That's not inherently a bad thing. There's some very stupid movies that I enjoy, even though I know if I think about them for 3 seconds, they are stupid movies.
Yeah,
I thought it was a good comedy. I haven't. The last couple comedies I've seen John in have been a load of fun. There was this one, and there was the one I forget the name of it, but he was the one of the parents of. He was a parent of it was the three parents and then three kids or whatever, and I forget what it was called, but that was a load of fun too.
Okay.
This is from a few years ago. I forget what it was. I'm kind of curious. I got to search up now.
Yeah,
that
right.
description was not helping me figure out what it was.
No, that didn't do me any good either. I couldn't pin that one down.
I'm looking at his Blockers. That's what it was called. Because it was like Cock Blocker.
Oh, okay.
I legit have never heard of that movie.
It came out in... I wish I
was
didn't close
that.
Was
it direct to streaming?
It might have been No, I think it was in movies, but it went to Netflix pretty fast. from 2018, so a couple years before the pandemic. It was... People were more focused on MCU. And stuff at this time. So it kind of went under the radar a bit, probably.
Wow, that looks like dog shit.
84% of the time. 6.2 out of 10. It's pretty fun. I had a lot of fun watching it. I haven't watched it in a few years, but.
Well, it might be better than it looks reading a brief IMDb summary of it. But the summary makes it sound terrible.
It's, again, like John Cena kind of steals the show. He's really good in comedy situations, I find.
Yeah. Well,
he throws his whole self into his role.
Oh, he does.
The willingness to make yourself look foolish, I think, is one of the advantages wrestlers turned actors have when they do comedies.
Yeah.
Because whether or not the comedy's good, they'll go all in on stuff that a lot of other actors don't seem to. Like, the one that springs instantly to mind for me was The Rock and the Tooth Fairy. It's a terrible movie.
Oh, it's horrible.
But he goes horrible. So hard on that when, like, no one else would.
Yeah, and Hulk Hogan did that Babysitter movie.
Yeah.
That was just pathetic.
But I'm not so sure he'd be willing to go hard on stuff that makes him look stupid, since most of his life seems to be devoted to lying about how awesome he is.
Yeah, but he's lampooned himself on more than one occasion.
Yes, but he's also claimed that Metallica only took Cliff Burton as the bassist because he refused.
Well, their loss, really.
He's also claimed that he once wrestled 400 days in a single year.
Sounds right.
Going back and forth across the international date line gave him extra days.
Yeah, works for me. Next thing you'd be telling me that Rob Zombie thinks he can make movies.
You think I'm lying about those claims, don't you?
No,
Those were both legit Hogan lies.
Yeah, I know.
I watched a whole podcast about stuff he's lied about before because it's so funny.
Oh, yeah. I watched like a whole 30 to 45 minute video just going through his lies that he's told.
Yeah. Well, I did go backwards in time a little bit, and I watched Predator, the original.
Interesting.
Again.
That's always worth a rewatch.
Yeah, just Jake the Snake. You know, I mean, wow. Or not Jake the Snake.
Jesse Ventura,
the governor of Michigan or whatever.
Yeah, before he went insane and conspiracy-brained.
Yeah, but, yeah, so wrestlers, like you say, they do have a natural advantage in going over the top just because of what they do.
Yeah.
But, you know, until Alexa Bliss decides to do a porno, I'm out of the game. Come on. You know you gotta post this on YouTube.
Sometimes I wonder about the...
About what?
About these going to YouTube.
No, we'll be fine.
There's just a black bar over Dan's window when we actually post this.
Yeah, probably. Yeah. Yeah, you got me on mute as far as the record goes, don't you?
Man, some of those comics just kind of disappear when they're...
Yeah, oh, speaking of all
it's all X-Men, it's no loss.
Yeah, speaking of all of that, have either of you watched Dairy Girls yet?
No, not yet.
Oh, you gotta watch the show.
I haven't managed to acquire Dairy Girls yet.
I'm trying to finish one of the shows I'm watching before I start anything else.
I've watched a lot of clips of it online, but I haven't watched an actual episode.
Yeah, Ryan may not have the actual historical context of when the show takes place, but it takes place just before the peace agreement in Ireland. So, and they're in Derry, you know, which is in Northern Ireland. And it's, you know, Ryan, for all intents and purposes, basically Ireland fought a 100-year war, 100-year plus war.
Yeah.
Between Protestants and Catholics. I think Ryan got that
because we talked about in the group chat, we talked about the scene about Protestants and Catholics trying to find something in common.
Yes. Yes. Right. And at that point in time, they were still shooting each other in the streets, Ryan. Like, seriously. A lot of these kids growing up in the era that they're portraying, these kids didn't want to get school buses because those buses could get blown up.
I mean, if you want to get a feel for that in a very short period of time, go watch the music video to Zombie by the Cranberries.
I was literally going
to
say.
Because like half that music video is literal B-roll. The director shot the day before by just walking around Belfast with a camcorder and filming whatever he saw.
I was literally about to say, just listen to Zombie. That's part of the reason I know about.
Yeah. Anything that doesn't directly have the band in it. Is B-roll, including those kids play fighting and jumping between the buildings.
Yeah. Yeah. And
that's one of my favorite songs.
Yeah. There's a movie in 2014 came out that I would suggest strongly both of you watch if you haven't seen it yet. It's called 71.
Oh, such a good movie.
Friggin' amazing film. Really unsettling and hard to watch.
Oh, yeah. It's on my great movies that I will never watch again.
Yeah. Yeah. I have no regrets watching it. It's basically, if you liked the zombie video, you need to see this movie. It'll give you all the context you need for a show like Derrick Rose. Right? That moment where Sister Michael introduces James to everybody. Says, well, we were going to put him in the boys' school, but unfortunately, we were worried for his safety because, well, he's English, right? And she wasn't kidding, right? That wasn't a joke. An English kid in Ireland back then would have got shot in the streets.
Oh, no doubt.
Yeah, you know, just for being English, right? So it's right. Anyway. If you get a chance, if and when you get a chance, you need to watch Dairy Girls. It's so good. It's brilliantly funny. It's Red Dwarf level good in that it's not particularly high production values, but oh boy, they cast it brilliantly. They act it brilliantly. They direct it brilliantly.
It's hard to believe some of the girls are pushing 40.
Oh, I know. I know.
They play like high school age girls so well.
Yeah, Sorsha. I can't remember her last name. Sorsha Monica something or other. Yeah, some of the girls are not that young, but the girl who plays Orla, Lisa something or other, the one in the that's always in the background eating candy, mm-hmm. has a new series out. Nellie, I believe it's called. It's about the highway woman, Nell.
Oh, yeah. I've seen ads for that.
Yeah. Yeah. That's the same girl that plays Orla.
Wow.
In the show. Yeah. So she's already become a bit of a name for herself. And at least two of the other girls have been doing a lot of publicity, too. So, right. It's the show has developed a life of its own. You know, there's people, it's only got three series, but people are screaming for another one.
I think they're doing a fourth.
Oh, that'd be epic. Just be
I'm
epic
pretty sure when I looked it up after you told me about it, they mentioned there was a fourth in production.
Oh, that'd be brilliant. It would be brilliant. It's a very sweet show. Anyway, we've just killed 20 minutes and got nothing done.
So a normal week at Route 616.
Yeah, take it away, George.
So, I mean, we have an interesting week this week, and by interest, I mean half the week is X-Men comics, and we're going to start with an X-Men comic today with number 19. This one is titled, Lo, Now Shall Appear, The Mimic. And we've got Stan Lee writing, we've got Jay Gavin on art, we've got Dick Gyres on inks, Jay Gavin did the cover, Artie Simic did letters, February 1966 release date, 20-page story, and I will take this one away. Now, I hope everybody's comfortable because this is going to take a few minutes. The X-Men are in an ever-training session supervised by Cyclops. The session is once more interrupted by Iceman's childish games, and the session is preempted temporarily while Psych takes Bobby down a peg. Cyclops then tests Hank's time record for dealing with a trapdoor test, which Hank passes with flying colors. The professor enters the room and applauds the students' good work. And tells them that after their great performance against the Sentinels and Magneto, and the fact that they are their fighting peak, he has assigned them all a brief vacation.
I can balance it out for you.
The team then off their costume identities and go into the city in their civilian guises.
Well, that's not fair.
Hank and Bobby go to the library where they are to meet Bobby's girlfriend,
Library.
Zelda.
2 hours.
To join Hank on a blind date with Zelda's friend Farrah. Hank has his reservations about meeting this woman, but becomes instantly smitten when he finds that Farrah works at a local library. Along the way to their scheduled date, they run into Calvin Rankin, a young man who has been trying to get Farrah to go out on dates with him. Jealous that Farrah is out with Hank, the hot-tempered Rankin starts to fight Hank. This is even worse than reading this comic. Hank pulls his punches, attempting to hide his mutant nature. However, when Hank attempts to fight back, he is surprised that Calvin somehow has powers the same as him. After he easily trounces Hank, Bobby attempts to fight back, but is hit in the face with a snowball by Calvin. Just then, construction workers notice the fight and attempt to stop Calvin from beating up Bobby. However, Calvin manages to dodge a thrown brick and suddenly creates an ice wall to protect him from other projectiles. Surprised at these new abilities, Calvin flees up the side of the building, evading the arriving construction workers. Surprised, Calvin recognizes his new abilities as powers that belong to two of the X-Men, and correctly deduces that Hank and Bobby are secretly Beast and Iceman. He then tests out his new abilities, hoping to use them to destroy the X-Men. However, they eventually fade away. Calvin forgot that the skills he mimics from others fade away once he is far enough away from the people he mimicked them from. Returning to the streets and going out for coffee, Calvin runs into Jean Grey while she is out shopping when she accidentally bumps into him. After rudely shouting at her, Calvin sits down at the table and realizes that he's also mimicked telekinetic powers and realizes the redhead he's bumped into is none other than Marvel Girl. Realizing the X-Men must be in town and their civilian identities, Calvin decides to follow Jean to discover the location of the X-Men's secret base. Oh.
Jesus, we're like halfway through this comic.
I know, I told you it was...
I had a joke about how I wasn't listening because I was trying to buy Dairy Girls, but this went on so long that the joke ran its course.
Showing up at the mansion wearing a pair of ruby quartz glasses and a harness so as to hide his mimicking of Cyclops and Angel's powers, Calvin shows up at the X-Mansion under the false pretense of apologizing for the fight he enticed earlier, and asks to join Xavier's school. He first mimics Professor X's telepathy when the professor attempts to mind probe Calvin and finds that he cannot access his mind. He then meets all of the X-Men.
I'm not really comfortable with Professor Xavier probing students.
Well, he tried to...
Sounds like it's a Catholic school.
I'm sure he uses protection.
I'm sure he doesn't. But anyways, mimicking their powers upon shaking their hands. The reception is less than warm, and Calvin realizes that none of the X-Men trust him. Allowed to be excused to go upstairs for a moment, the professor tells his charges that he suspects that Rankin is up to no good, and since he has deduced the X-Men's identities, that they should change into their costumes and be prepared for an attack. Sure enough, Calvin returns downstairs wearing a specially made costume, calling himself Mimic. He tells the X-Men that he intends to defeat them with copies of their own powers. Mimic then takes down Angel with a combination of his and Beast's powers, deflects attacks from Cyclops and Iceman by using the opposite powers as a defense against the attacks. With one-on-one attacks ineffectual, the professor orders the X-Men to attack Mimic as a team. Mimic manages to defend himself and fight the X-Men off. As the team of mutants regroup, Mimic then nabs Marvel Girl and flees in the car, with her as the hostage. The X-Men follow in their helicopter, hoping to catch him before he can harm Jean. Jesus Christ. Mimic, now with all the stolen powers gone except for Marvel Girl's telekinetic power, takes Jean to an abandoned mine where Jean is surprised to find a hidden living space within. There, Mimic tells Jean his startling origins. He explains that his father was a scientist who disallowed Calvin to ever enter his lab. However, one day the defiant Calvin was snooping around his father's lab and accidentally knocked over a beaker filled with chemicals his father was working on, causing it to smash open and cover him with a strange gas. Finding that he is okay, Calvin soon realizes that the exposure to the chemicals somehow changed him. When in a schoolyard brawl with the school's boxing champ, he somehow developed his opponent's boxing skills. Later, he would find that he could absorb the skills of those who were around. However, his sudden bouts of perfection caused his friends to become suspicious of him and shun him. Learning what had happened to his son and suspecting the people in town would eventually turn against his boy, Calvin's father relocated him to an abandoned mine in the hopes of working on a way to make his son's powers permanent. However, the experiments required a heavy use of power. The townspeople learned the source of the power drain and informed the mob converging on the cave. Warned of their coming by his alarm system, Calvin's father attempted to bar their attack by blasting closed the main entrance. However, he underestimated the force of the explosion, and this oversight cost the Elder rank in his life. The machine that could potentially make Mimic's powers permanent was buried in the explosion. After his father's body was buried, the young Calvin vowed to get revenge on the world once he found a way to make his power permanent. With his story finished, Jean properly deduces that Mimic intends to use the X-Men's powers in order to clear the rubble and free the machine that could make Mimic unbeatable. Mimic soon detects the arrival of the other X-Men when Angel's wings begin to sprout from his back once more. Rushing to the cave, Mimic then uses his returning optic blast to begin clearing through the debris. Meanwhile, the X-Men cautiously enter the cave and free Jean, who would warn them of Mimic's plans. Mimic, meanwhile, has managed to break his way through to his father's lab, and before he can open the door to the device he seeks, he's attacked by the X-Men, who have caught up with him. Mimic manages to fight off the X-Men and grab Professor as his hostage to keep the X-Men at bay while he uses his father's machine. However, instead of making his mimicking powers permanent, the device actually strips Calvin of his ability and knocks him out in the process. The X-Men, realizing the machine is overloading, carry the professor and Rankin to safety before it explodes, destroying the entire lab. Yeah. The X-Men then change Calvin back to a civilian guise, and the professor removes all memory of his identity as Mimic and sends the boy on his way. hoping that he can get a fresh new start with Fred of Mimic ended, the X-Men return home. Fuck. It's done.
Yeah. Well, mine's not going to be any better.
I know, I looked.
Oh my god. Well, you got through it.
Barely.
It was harder than actually reading the comic.
It was.
Probably took longer than reading the comic.
Probably.
Almost. And X-Men comics take long time.
This one wasn't too wordy in the actual comic. It got the, like, real bad when Roy Thomas takes over on the next issue.
Yeah, this one was pretty solid. I gave this one a 3.
Yeah, this one was a 3. When it's I was complaining about Mimic being terrible, I was thinking of the next time he turns up when he joins the X-Men.
Okay.
I'd forgotten this issue even existed. It's fine. It's inoffensive, which is really the best you can hope for 60s pre-cancellation X-Men.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, moving quickly past that one, since we still have two more X-Men to cover later in the episode, we shall move into Daredevil number 15. This one's titled, And Men Shall Call Him Ox. Stan Lee writes this, John Romita Sr. makes his debut with this issue. I think this is his debut, isn't it? Or did he debut already?
I think he already did one or two before this.
Oh, yeah, he debuted there in the Plunderer arc, didn't he? Yeah, he did. Yeah.
Because I know they were testing him out for a bit before they gave him Spider-Man.
Yeah. Letters by Artie Simek. February 1966, release date, 20-page story, and Bill shall cover this one.
All right. I thought I had a long one, but after listening to X-Men, I do not have a long one. Having returned to New York following his adventures with Kesar in England, Daredevil returns to his apartment and resumes his guise as Matt Murdock just as Foggy and Karen have arrived. Foggy almost faints, a remission to the injuries sustained from Ox many months ago. Meanwhile, in the state prison, the Ox himself has teamed with his cellmate, Carl Skrag, who offers his scientific know-how to give the Ox the intelligence he always wanted in exchange for busting them out of prison. However, when they break out of prison and escape to Skrag's lab, the device Skrag uses instead switches their body. Skrag's plot all along, and the now super-strong Skrag goes on a rampage. It's during the rampage that Skrag is spotted by Karen Page, who recognizes him as the Ox, while Daredevil happens to swing by and see the behemoth. Daredevil battles him, but Ox easily defeats the masked hero and places an extra Ox costume on Daredevil, so that when the police arrive, they think that Daredevil is masquerading as the Ox to get away with crime and lock him up. Meanwhile, Skrag takes Karen back to his lab, where the original Ox, now in Strag's body, knocks Skrag out and helps Karen escape. Skrag then goes on another rampage, leading the police to realize they have the wrong person and set Daredevil free to deal with the menace. Their fight takes them to the top of a building where the fighting mad Skrag in Ox's body accidentally runs off the edge of the building and plummets to his death. After the battle, Daredevil returns to his civilian guise and meets with Karen and Foggy. He finds that Foggy will be okay, while Karen wonders what happened to the man who saved her from the Ox. The story closes with the original Ox feeling better and a little smarter in his new body as he decides to return to prison to finish his sentence.
Well, that's good of him.
So, when we were talking about stuff that's not objectively good, but we really like earlier.
Yeah.
This is not an objectively good comic, but okay. I really like it.
I did really? Too. I gave it a 3.
I gave it a 3. It almost got higher for the Ox stuff.
Ox has always been a boy of mine.
Yeah. The whole thing about him, like, actually having to grow as a person because he got betrayed was really good. The problem was, there was a lot of stuff in this comic that was not good. Such as Skrag just randomly running off a building while fighting with Daredevil. Because it's not like Daredevil helps toss him off the building or so. He literally misjudges charging at Daredevil and falls off the building.
hopeful. You know.
I find the science very interesting in this comic that if you just simply switch bodies, you start to become the person whose body you took over. So that was interesting. Marvel science.
Yeah, because I think long-term, spoilers, Ox comes back. So, but I think long-term, Strag effectively committed suicide with that body swap and then killing off his own body, or killing off Ox's body, because Ox eventually just turns back into Ox.
Yeah.
I don't remember how they explain it, but eventually
they might not even explain it.
I'm pretty sure there is an explanation at some point, but I don't remember what it was. But he actually gets the big, strong body back.
Okay.
It's also quite possible that they actually just forgot they killed that body.
Yeah.
So that was Daredevil. We'll be getting much more of him very soon. But
I'm sorry for that.
Not this week, as now we get our Amazing Spider-Man dose with issue 36. This one's titled When Falls the Meteor. Stan Lee and Steve Ditko still together here. Artie Simic on letters. February 1966 for the state 20-page story, and Bill will also take this one.
Before I start, I want to mention that that together, Ryan said, is doing a lot of work, because we're in Steve comes in when Stan's not around, dumps the script or dumps the art on his desk and leaves before Stan comes back face. And it'll show in this story. A meteor comes crashing down and Norton Fester, a scientist, retrieves it and looks for funding in order to research microscopic life on it.
Sorry.
Professional production as always here at Route 616. Yeah. Thanks for watching.
Sorry, guys.
After being turned down by a bank and his friends, he cracks it open himself. As he does, a trapped pocket of gas emits and he stumbles backwards. So yes, he got farted on by a meteor.
Okay.
When he awakens, he discovers a newfound strength and lifts a bookcase as if it were a feather. Meanwhile, Peter Parker is back on campus trying to regain a normal social life. As he tries to socialize, he gets worried about being pegged as an egghead and afraid to repeat his mistakes with Betty, brushes them off. That sentence made no sense, but what actually happened is Gwen invites him to a party. He agrees to come. Then she says that it will be nice to have someone who's actually smart there. And he gets all worried that they just think of him as an egghead and they're going to end up like Betty. So he's like, actually, I can't go to that party. Sorry. And then they're all like, wow, what a dick. This is the sort of human interaction you get when no one's talking to each other writing it.
Yeah.
Inside a bank, we see Norton Fester is now the looter. He robs the bank and blinds those inside with a dazzle gun. As he continues to rob banks over the next few days, Looter finds there's no more gas in his meteor and decides to find another just in case his power diminishes. Coincidentally, Peter Parker is attending a space exhibit and Gwen Stacy happens to show up as well. Gwen becomes frustrated when Peter only notices the exhibits and is completely oblivious to her presence. Because, you know, she doesn't go talk to him or anything. She just hangs around behind him and gets upset that he doesn't see her. Looter shows up.
Talk to me. I'm hot.
Yeah, she doesn't even enter his line of sight, though. That's the best thing about it. He's just supposed to like sense that there's a hot person around him.
Yeah, only Spider-Man would be able to, you know, have spider sense to tell that something was going on.
That's just dangerous. She needs to do it to Matt Murdock if she wants to get creeped on, or Mike Murdock, really.
She needs to do something dangerous to get his attention.
Yeah.
Looter shows up.
Looter shows up to steal the meteor, and Spider-Man arrives to prevent it. The looter uses his dazzle gun to blind everyone and escape. Peter returns to try and talk to Gwen, but she writes him off as a coward when he ran and changed. Spider-Man figures Looter will be back and is proven correct when another robbery is attempted. Unsuccessful in his second attempt, Looter attempts to fly away with a helium balloon, but Spider-Man springs up a flagpole and catches him. After he knocks him out cold, Spider-Man sails the balloon for the police to arrest Looter before knowing why the meteor was sought after. And that's the end.
Okay.
Can't believe you went with such a simple name as the Looter when Meteor Man was right there.
Well, you see, that would have required Stan and Steve to talk.
Yeah.
He would have had to put a big M on his costume. And that would have required coordination.
A nice M in, like, green to go with his purple and black.
Purple and green.
Yeah, gotta have the green on there to announce that he's a villain.
That's right. Mm-hmm.
This was not good for Spider-Man, but it was fine for a comic of this time.
So a 3?
Low, begrudging 3.
Yes, very much so. Barely passing 3. I kind of got a kick out of the Looter, but it's definitely not a character that had the most thought put into it.
No, and the Looter stuff was the better stuff, ironically, in this. We always say the good thing about Spider-Man is the, like, interpersonal interactions. But they were terrible here because...
Don't say that. You guys say that.
Steve went off and drew a bunch of stuff and dumped it on Stan's desk. And Stan came in and had no idea what was going on and just wrote a bunch of speech balloons in there anyway.
Turns out Stan doesn't know how to talk to people.
It does.
Which probably explains his career and why people hate him.
Yes. But yeah, I'll be glad when Romita shows up on Spider-Man. How many more do we have? I don't think this is the last Ditko Spider-Man.
Just rake the bloody thing and get it over with.
Oh, we already did. You weren't paying attention.
Funny that, you know, because I have an entire Bible's length of write up here to go through.
You sure do.
Holy Christ.
The Psalms of Lucifer.
Aye.
Just remember, it was probably more painful to read that comic.
Well, it's going to be pretty fucking painful to listen to me read through this.
Just wait for Bill to figure out the answer.
That's Machine Man. Okay, there are 2 more.
Oh, wow.
The robot one that I remember actually quite liking. And then... Just a guy named Joe.
So I've read his second last one then. I've read the next one. I didn't realize I was that close. Wow.
Yeah.
Anyways, it's going to be sad to see Deco leave, but we'll get to a better spot eventually.
I don't think Machine Man is a better spot.
Well, I didn't mean for Deco. I meant for Spider-Man. Although Machine Man is a total boy as well.
Never anyway, read any Machine Man.
He's popped up more in modern comics, and he's a fun character.
I'm very close to the start of Machine Man, but I haven't read it yet.
Anyways, we shall move into X-Men number 20, titled I, Lucifer. It's Roy Thomas takes over writing. That's right, Roy Thomas takes over. That explains a lot, to be honest.
Yes, that's why it got so wordy. The story's made... slightly more sense narratively, but they're barely able to see the art because there's so many speech balloons.
Poor Roy Thomas. He came in trying to wrap up Stan's loose ends.
Yeah.
Oh, that makes so much sense now why this sucks. Anyways, J. Gavin Inc. Art does art. Dick Ayers inks.
Not like J. you Gavin can see the art in this one.
Artie Simic does the letters. March 1966, release date, 20-page story. And Dan is about to read some Bible verses for us.
Okay. Okay, everybody, take a seat. I hope you went to the bathroom, because here we go. I, Lucifer, wearing X-Men costumes, Blob and Anus the Untouchable, or holding up a bank so that the X-Men would be implicated for the crime. Neither the bank security guard or the police proved to be a match for the untouchable and unmovable duo who succeed in robbing the bank. While at the X-Men's mansion, Scott, afraid of his uncontrollable optic blast and the fact that he cannot bring himself to tell Jean his true feelings for her, decides that he must leave the X-Men. Yay!
For anybody keeping track, it took 20 issues, for Cyclops to leave the team for the first time.
Yeah, it'll take 20 issues just to get through this friggin' write-up. Without telling anyone, Scott packs a bag and leaves the mansion on foot. Warren, Jean, Bobby, and Hank are relaxing in the study when a news report about Blobbert and Anus's bank robbery comes on the air. With the X-Men implicated in the robbery, the team rushes down to the professor's study where Charles has just finished building a new Cerebro machine. The machine then reveals the identity of the two X-Men who robbed the bank, and Hank recognizes them as Blobbert and Anus. The professor senses a third adversary involved in this crime and attempts to use his mental powers to learn who it is, but finds that some force prevents him. Man, they wrote themselves into a corner and now they have no way to get out of it. To make matters worse, Bobby enters the room after failing to find Scott and hands over a note written by Summers explaining to the professor that he really doesn't like anybody on the team because they're all dicks, so he's going to go somewhere where people are nice. Unable to devote time to finding Scott, the professor sends out the other X-Men to get ready to face their enemies. Far away, the X-Men's unknown foe is none other than the alien being that was responsible for crippling Professor Xavier, the evil Lucifer. With his plan in motion, the evil alien muses over how he manipulated Blob and Unus from afar. Some time ago, his scanners detected the meeting of Blob and Unus. When the two men challenged each other to see who would win, the untouchable man or the immovable Blob. The match ended in a stalemate when the two men found out their powers were evenly matched. After the bout, they were manipulated from afar by Lucifer's machines to team up and work together as crooks, robbing whatever they wanted. As Lucifer continues his plot, Scott happens by the Blob and Unus as they are robbing an armored car. Realizing that the two evil mutants' actions would reflect negatively on the X-Men, Cyclops changes into costume and confronts his two foes. However, instead of being able to stop Bob and Unus and expose their frame-up, Cyclops only succeeds in enraging the crowd of people into a mob. In a fit of anti-mutant hysteria, the crowd chases Cyclops away, rationalizing that he's the most dangerous of the three mutants. And the fact they didn't hurt any of them doesn't seem to sink in. Okay. Watching the scene on his monitors, Lucifer is angry that their activities have only revealed one X-Man. However, he becomes satisfied when he spots the other members of the team arriving on the scene, minus Marvel Girl, who remained with the professor. Beast arrives first and uses the device he previously used to increase Unus's powers. However, Unus has since become immune to the effects of the rays, thanks to the secret machinations of Lucifer. The X-Men try their best to fight off the two evil mutants. However, the crowd and police impede the team's efforts as they fail to realize the X-Men are fighting against the imposters and think they're all in league with Lucifer. For all you Highlander fans out there, much to the joy of Lucifer, the battle takes a pitch in the opposite direction when Cyclops returns to the scene and knocks the two foes off their feet when he blasts the ground out from under them. Unfortunately, this causes the two to fall down into the subway tunnel below onto a subway train that just happened to be passing by. With an angry mob chasing them, the X-Men welcome Cyclops back into the fold and seek a hiding place until the mob subsides. Oh, dear Lord. Back at Lucifer's base, the alien mastermind is alerted that Professor X is attempting to break through his metal screens. Prepared for this contingency, Lucifer prepares a gigantic weapon that fires a powerful disruption beam, attacking the professor's mind, putting him in a coma-like state. Still conscious but rendered inert and weakened, the professor telepathically orders Marvel Girl to get and wear his mental wave amplifier so she can hear his thoughts. In doing so, the professor learns that the mastermind behind this attack against the X-Men is Lucifer. Professor X then tells Jean the story of how he first encountered Lucifer. Years ago, while traveling through Tibet. Why is it always Tibet?
Because it's the only place they can think of where mystical stuff might happen.
Oh, okay. Fair enough. The professor became investigated a walled-off city. When he is barred from entry, he coaxes the guards into letting him in with his metal powers. His presence in the town attracts the attention of Lucifer, who is monitoring the strange visitor. The professor learns that the people of the town live in fear of its ruler, and with his metal probes, he learns that Lucifer's castle has cached weaponry machines from another world within. The professor organized a group of villagers and tried to convince them to follow him in a revolt. They remain unconvinced until Lucifer attempts to kill them. With an army at his command, the professor stormed Lucifer's castle and destroyed much of the machinery inside. Lucifer is then contacted by his leader and told to abandon his base and to go to another sector that is key to their invasion plans for Earth. Fleeing the scene, the alien... God, this is just pedantic. Fleeing the scene, the alien crossed paths with the professor, Xavier attempted to stop Lucifer from escaping, but Lucifer activated a trap, dropping a stone block on Charles, crushing his legs and confining him to a wheelchair. Lucifer escaped and ending his story. The professor explains that part of his reasons for forming the X-Men were for the purpose of dealing with the threat of Lucifer, should he appear again. Please tell me the next one's not this long. Back at a secret hideout, Lucifer muses on how his devices have been able to sway the behaviors of an entire town. And soon he will build a device that will affect the entire world, put the entire human race under his control. With his plans almost coming to fruition, Lucifer calls his masters and requests they send Dominus, who is part of the final phase of their conquest of Earth. With the hysterical mob now gone, the X-Men leave their hiding place and return to the X-Mansion, where they learn the professor's situation and Lucifer's involvement in the day's events. In order to face Lucifer with their leader by their side, Beast creates a mental distorter, which protects the professor from the effects of Lucifer's weapon.
It's a fishbowl. He puts a fishbowl on his head.
Okay.
They have some, like, Kirby-esque science stuff stuck to it, but basically the professor's walking around with a fishbowl on his head.
Jesus.
Wheeling around, I should say.
Sure. Anyway, with the professor restored to normal, the team loads up in their jet and flies off to the location of Lucifer's base to stop his planned conquest of Earth, unaware of the danger which faces them there. The story continues next issue.
Unfortunately.
God, that was just painful.
Not good. Only gave this one a 2. This is not good.
I also only gave this one a 2.
The Lucifer shit sucks.
It's wordy. It's got Lucifer in it. It's got anus in it. And yes, I know I'm pronouncing that wrong. Don't leave a comment about it. He's an anus if you've read any of these comics.
Yeah, they just do a 180 with that character.
This is just not a fun comic at all. There's nothing enjoyable about reading it.
It's a Jay Gavin
art probably would be good if you could see it, but there are so many word bubbles in every panel that you can't even really appreciate the art.
Yeah, it's more of an annoyance to read than anything.
Yeah, this was peak Roy Thomas's belief that if a character appears in the image, they have to say something.
Okay, well, This next one's better. It's shorter.
The story is not better, for the record.
Oh, okay.
X-Men number 21, just so we can get through this. From Whence Comes Dominus. Roy Thomas writing this, obviously. Jay Gavin on art. Dick Ayers on inks. Jay Gavin on cover art. Sam Rosen on the letters. April 1966 release date. 20-page story. And Dan will hopefully put us out of our misery relatively fast.
Oh, yeah. If this doesn't put you to sleep, nothing will. Okay. From Whence Comes Dominus? The X-Men are racing toward the secret hideout of their alien foe, Lucifer, when their ship is suddenly deflected by a strange force field. Shit. Language. Flying away from the scene to find another way through, the team notices strange objects being pulled out of the sky into the mysterious base. Also witnessing the spectacle is Porter Mack. Okay, the owner of a dude ranch near Buchanan's Butte. The location of the disturbance. Feeling that the strange goings-on will drive away his customer base, he takes some of his best men out to investigate the disturbance to try and find a way to stop it. Meanwhile, the X-Men circle the butte until the strange light source disappears. Upon approaching the butte, they cannot get any closer because it suddenly starts spraying a geyser of hot water at them. X-Men land further away and spot a nearby stream that goes under the butte. X-Men decide to investigate to see if it's a safe passage into their foe's hideout. Leaving their plane, the team leaves the professor behind as they begin to search for a way into the base. Along the way, they are spotted and attacked by Porter and his posse, who think there may be a reward for the X-Men since they are still wanted criminals back east. However, the X-Men make short work of their would-be attackers, sending them sprawling into the river when they retreat. They seal Porter in an ice block around his arms and load the would-be attacker on a horse, sending him packing to his ranch. Continuing to search for an entrance, the X-Men, my God, the X-Men make their way to the river and have Iceman create a nice raft for them to ride along. Why don't you just freeze the river and make skates? Be quicker. They
the nice one would be useful.
Yeah, it might show a little imagination. They follow the river to the underground opening and find themselves caught in a whirlpool. As the X-Men are swept away, the professor is shocked to find that telepathic contact with his students has been severed. Before Xavier can do anything about it, he is confronted by two robots commanded by Lucifer, who capture him and carry him away into the base. Taken before Lucifer himself, the professor is put at the aliens' mercy with the robots inquiring if they can destroy the telepathic mutant. Lucifer refuses the request, telling the robots and the professor that he prefers Xavier lives so that he can witness a Dominus supercomputer enslaves as the Dominus computer enslaves the entire world.
Sometimes X-Men is better when Xavier dies.
Yeah, okay, well, are we ready for the second part of this?
No.
Elsewhere in Lucifer's base, the X-Men are separated, and Angel, Cyclops, and Marvel Girl get captured. Beast and Iceman, meanwhile, are attacked by another Dominus robot that attempts to capture them, but fails to stop the young mutants. They manage to escape the robot, but then run right into a metal wall that knocks them out, allowing them to be captured. Great, it's turning into a Seinfeld episode. With all the
Please
X-Men...
Please don't disparage Seinfeld.
With all the X-Men as prisoners, Lucifer gloats, tends to use the Dominus computer to activate a device that would strip humanity of their individual wills and turn them into slaves, work as slaves of the Quist aliens that Lucifer is a member of. Oh, my Lord, dying Christ. Meanwhile, the X-Men attempt to break out of their prison, but to no avail. When the Dominus robots place Iceman and Beast into their cell, they fail to free themselves as they are pushed back by an incredible force. However, the X-Men manage to free themselves when Jean uses her telekinetic powers to operate the release switch on the cell's control panel. Freed, they ambush the one robot left to guard them and race towards Lucifer's control room. With the alarm sounding, Lucifer sends his robots out to try and stop the X-Men. X-Men duck out of sight to avoid detection and then rush Lucifer. They get a mental command from the professor telling them not to damage the computer. However, Iceman and Angel don't believe the command came from the professor and attempt to destroy it anyway. but Marvel Girl and Cyclops stop. This leads to a brief scuffle between teammates until they all decide to hold off destroying the computer until they've dealt with Lucifer and his robots. The X-Men destroy all the robots, and with his robots destroyed, Lucifer stops the battle and rushes to his communication device for more orders. When the Supreme Leader appears on the screen, he informs Lucifer that with the Ultra Robots, the only thing that could operate the computer destroyed, their mission is a failure. He tells Lucifer to return to their home planet to be punished. Suddenly, right before their eyes, Lucifer and all his equipment are teleported away. Bless you. With the threat passed, the professor explains to his students that through his mental probing, he had learned the Dominus computer had a specific defense mechanism. It would redirect any force thrown against it right back at its attackers, putting his students at risk. That's the reason why he ordered them not to attack the computer directly. With all explained, the X-Men and the professor depart the base to return home, unsure where Lucifer came from or if the aliens he represented will threaten the Earth again. If it wasn't for the fact that this guy's the reason Professor X is in a wheelchair, this would be an absolutely pointless story.
Yeah, and they even tried to retcon that he was the reason Charles was in the wheelchair and replace him with Juggernaut, which thematically makes way more sense and is much cooler, but Stan was having none of it, and he's like, no, fuck you, it's Lucifer.
So we see. That was not enjoyable.
Not good.
No.
And believe me, that summary is better than the actual comic. I've read this comic twice, and then I read the summary because I still didn't fucking know what was happening in the comic.
Yeah. Well, the thing is, I've absolutely nothing against comics getting a little deeper, stories becoming a little more involved, you know, delving into characters and motivations and the personalities and all that. So I don't have a problem with that, but there still needs to be a point behind your weekly adventure.
Yeah.
You know, the summary alone just went on and on and on without anything really exciting to talk about.
Yeah. And I'll give you the depressing news.
Okay.
That is a summary.
Yeah.
It's not. It summarizes what happens in those comic books.
Jeez.
About as much as the Spider-Man summary I read that was three paragraphs long.
Yeah.
Because those comics are so wordy and so dense with Roy Thomas trying to fix the mess he inherited on that book.
Well, and this is probably going to start a conversation we don't want to have in this podcast this week, but one of the primary points behind a comic book is it's a visual representation of a story.
Yeah, you still need the story.
Yeah, you still need the talking and blah, blah, blah. Plot points sometimes occasionally need to be mentioned, but you're supposed to tell the story as much with the art as you are with the word bubbles.
Yeah.
You know, and this just feels like the art was completely inconsequential to the story.
It was. Like I said, Roy Thomas came in with the belief that if a person is pictured in the panel, they have to say something in that panel. This is an X-Men comic, so there's always four or five people pictured in every panel. And so you have four or five people saying variants on the same thing. Quite often, Roy can't think of anything interesting for them all to be saying, but they have to be talking. So he's just gotten them blabbering on about inane stuff just because they have to. And it completely fills the panel. It makes the comic take forever to read, so you don't get a good flow going through the story. And you can't see what's happening because the panel's completely full of art or words. So, yeah, barely a two.
So, barely a two. I'm impressed. Ryan?
Pretty much barely a two.
Wow.
This sucked.
Yeah.
Well,
that was. That wasn't enjoyable.
Neither was reading it.
No, it wasn't. Well, we have the last comic of the day with a Surge and Fury, and this is the one that should be interesting to see some reactions to. We have Surge and Fury and his Howling Commandos number 30. This one's titled Incident in Italy. Stanley not writing because Roy Thomas took over. Roy Thomas is writing. Dick Ayers on art. John Tertiglione on inks. Tertiglione and Ayers both did the cover together of Force 2. Letters by Sam Harrison. March 1966 release date, 20-page story. This is long, but very broken up into small paragraphs, so I can probably get through it pretty quick. After parachuting over Italy, Sergeant Fury and his Howling Commandos find themselves surrounded by the local military groups. During the battle, Fury orders his unit to surrender to the Italians, but it turns out that getting captured was part of the plan. Inside the camp, the Howlers are welcomed by Captain Andre of the Royal Canadian Air Force, and he is about to discuss an escape plan with the newcomers, but an Italian guard takes Fury's men to the prison commander, Major Carlo. Once in his office, the Major sends his men outside to speak alone with the prisoners. Free to speak, Fury tells the others that Carlo is the contact they are expected to meet. The officer is secretly a member of the Italian partisan movement, and he is supposed to help them in their current operation. Fury's men learn that Italian dictator Benito Mussolini had stashed a large supply of gold on a remote farm in the north of the country. The intelligence report claims that... I don't know how to actually say that.
Il Duce
is secretly securing some savings in the likely case the Axis would lose the war. The commander's mission is to steal the gold and bring it back to the Allied forces. Carlo tells the Howlers they will be able to break out of the prisoner of war camp through a hidden tunnel, on the other end of which partisan trucks will be waiting for them. Then he orders his men back in and assigns the prisoner to forced labor near the location of the tunnel. Shortly after, Dino's eavesdrops and informs him that the Major is being arrested for investigation due to some family ties. The commando reports his findings to Fury, who decides to move their plans ahead and act immediately by attacking some officers who are taking the Major away. The rest of the prisoners join the fight, and the camp is soon overtaken. Captain Andre decides that he and his men will create a diversion to keep the Italian forces busy while the Italian Major and the Howlers go about their mission. At the other end of the tunnel, they meet with the partisans and take off with 7 trucks. Dino travels with the Major and learns he has relatives in America, whereas Fury shares a truck with a clever young partisan who turns out to be a woman. This synopsis is badly written.
I'm pretty sure I know who wrote it, and they're like, English is their third language.
Fair enough. After Carlo manages to get the group inside Mussolini's farm, they find the officers in charge and force them to reveal the location of the gold. While they dig Mussolini's reserves up, one of the guards grows suspicious and calls the headquarters to check if everything is okay. Percy handles the situation as best he can, keeping in mind that they have to hurry because the place will soon be infested with enemy scout planes. When the trucks are loaded with all the gold, the caravan leaves the farm, only to be intercepted by 2 bombers. Reb then takes matters in his own hands and guns them down. Further down the road, a fascist tank approaches to stop the convoy. While Izzy and Gabe distract the driver, Fury sneaks in from behind and blows it up with a grenade. As they come close to their rendezvous point with the amphibious vehicle waiting for them, the convoy is attacked by a squadron of enemy planes. In the middle of the explosions, the Howlers and Italian partisans do their best to transfer their cargo into the vehicles. The Allied destroyer waiting for them offshore sends reinforcement, and the Howlers are good to go. Fury offers Carlo to come to England with them, but the Major decides to stay where he's needed the most. He also adds that during a journey he learned that he and Dino Minnelli were cousins. Minnelli bids farewell to the girl whose name is Sophia, promising that after the war he will take her to Hollywood and make her a star.
So, this summary squashed over a lot of the infuriating stuff about Sophia.
Yeah, the parts that make Dan annoyed. You're still muted, by the way, Dan.
Hi.
Hi.
That was to mute my cries of despair as you read that fucking thing.
Yeah.
So, Dan, have you figured out who the girl is?
Because
she's real.
Anne Frank?
Sophia Loren.
Greta Garbo?
It's Sophia Loren.
Wow. Okay.
They fucked up her age. Because she's 16 when she should be 11.
You have fun?
Always do.
But she is clearly intended to be Sophia Loren.
She was a go-to girl for everybody back then.
You missed part of that, but she was made 16 in this comic when she was supposed to be 11 or whatever.
Okay.
Which is really bad because Dino is hitting on her like a motherfucker in this.
Yeah, they made her 16 to make it less creepy when the adult man hits on her.
Well, okay.
Although, having read a lot of old comics, I can say that really is a matter of norms changing over time.
Yeah.
Because it's quite common in old comics for 16-year-olds and adult men to flirt in comics. So I think it was much more accepted of the time than it is nowadays.
Definitely. It's still gross to go back to, though.
Oh, yeah. It's gross reading it from a modern perspective. And honestly, Dino flirting with her in those circumstances is gross anyway, even if she was also an adult.
Yeah, that's also true.
Because, like, her family was just killed by the Italian government. And, hey, baby, want to go lay some pipe?
What you doing, little lady?
Fucking Dino.
Oh, shit.
Yeah, okay.
So, yeah, that was Sergeant Fury. Interest in historical representation is always from that comic.
Yeah. Sorry, Sunday, but I was full of people.
So it's okay.
We'll wrap this up relatively quickly.
We're just wrapping up, so not the worst.
We gave this, I'm sure both of us gave this, well, I know we both gave this a 3 because Bill showed their rating.
This was better than a lot of the Sergeant Furies we covered earlier, despite the yikesy stuff with Sophia Loren. But it wasn't a great comic. It just, it's fine. It's an adventure. Don't regret reading it, but if I never read it, my life would not be changed.
At least it was a different setting in Italy.
I mean, Sergeant Fury, it had zero cultural impact at the time.
Yeah. It's just a fun war comic to enjoy.
Yeah. So on that note, we'll get out of here relatively quickly so Dan can go frolic with the others. And we've got next week, it's only a 5 comic. Only a 5 comic episode next week because you'll find out why.
Spider-Man, I will hunt you to fuck down.
There is a Spider-Man next week. Only one of them is a Spider-Man 37. It starts the episode. Then after that, we have 4 Daredevils. That's
two
why
of which
we only
feature Spider-Man.
So yes, technically it is. It's pretty much 3 Spider-Mans, really.
Did I mention I was going to be sick next week?
So 1 Spider-Man, 4 Daredevils, and that will take Daredevil 16 through 19. By the way. And that will be our episode next week. So, should be interesting. Dan is going to be held down to a chair and have his
forced
eyes taped
to
open.
Summarize one of these. Yeah. Give me the Spider-Man. I freaking dare you. I freaking dare you.
Yeah. We'll give you the full Clockwork Orange.
You're going to have to. It's a sin. It's a sin. Yeah. Anyway,
on that note, if you're watching this on YouTube, please would like to subscribe, comment, even share if you would like to. We're also available on Google Podcasts, Apple Podcasts, and Spotify. If you're listening to Spotify, click that poll. Let us know which comic was your favorite for us to talk about today. Let us know why you like torture and enjoyed those X-Men of Lucifer. Anyways, we will see you on the next episode. And peace out.
Peace out, guys.
Have a good one, everyone.
Dan's gonna go frolic.
Oh, yeah.
Don't break a hip.